Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. I started getting blog notices from an outfit calling itself the New Revenant Society, and I got interested. It turns out they were a couple of young guys, Chris M. and Chris S., as they style themselves, who bought a piece of property in rural Virginia with the intention of dropping out, starting a tea plantation, yes, like breakfast tea, and becoming self-sufficient. Chris M. is an author with a forthcoming book and a former counterintelligence analyst, and Chris S. has a degree in environmental sustainability and has a passion for permaculture, tiny houses, and, of course, tea. And so without further throat clearing, here is my conversation with Chris M. and Chris S. of the New Revenant Society. And I'm talking to Chris M. and Chris S., as they style themselves, of the New Revenant Society. And they're a couple of young homesteaders down in Virginia. Can I say that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I won't say where exactly. And we're going to talk about homesteading and what New Revenant actually is, and economic collapse and the things that are prompting all of us to have to think about living in a new disposition of things. So, Chris M. and Chris S., where were you in life? How old were you when you decided to set out on this homesteading path? And what led up to it?
Well, I would say for me, this is Christopher Michael. I would say when I met Chris, we had talked about that we wanted to be more simple. We kind of were reading a lot of your work, a lot from Chris Martinson, John Michael Greer, in understanding that the way that we've been living as a society is not working. And so we had made the decision kind of together, hey, we're going to shoot towards this. It wasn't really until COVID that we decided to pull the trigger and move full time into it.
That's right. Yeah. This is Christopher David. We made the decision back in 2017 that we needed to start looking for a property. And we were saving as much as we could. We weren't doing all the things that younger people do, just to save up enough to get a piece of property somewhere. And as luck would have it, we found, after a year of searching, we found 11 acres about 4 hours away from our apartment in Frederick, Maryland. And COVID came on the scene. And, you know, we just decided, okay, so we have a tiny house. It was almost completed by then, that we could come down to and live in and just try to get away from all the craziness going on in the world. So then in May of 2020, our lease was up and we made the jump into this lifestyle.
How old were you when all this happened? Were you like all grown up, full-fledged adults or out of college or what?
I was 30 and Chris David was 32.
Yep.
So you were full-fledged adults.
Yeah. Pretty adult.
And you had been adults for a good decade. So tell me something about the journey that you made psychologically and intellectually to apprehend that things were going south in industrial society.
When I was in college, I graduated in 2012. I had my degree in environmental sustainability, and we were taught, during that time, it was kind of like the bubble for alternative energies, and there were solar panels going up everywhere. And we were taught, or more or less indoctrinated in college, that, you know, peak oil is real, and we need to be taking steps to switch our high consumption lifestyle to another high consumption lifestyle, but we're going to use solar, wind, water to do that. And it really just didn't jive with me. And then when I got out of college, I saved up and made a tiny house. I got into permaculture, and I made my tiny house out of a shed, and had some solar panels hooked up to it on my parents' property. And then I met Chris, and he got to see the tiny house, and then we just went from there.
Yeah, and for me, when I left high school, I kind of did a little bit of a different thing. I went in the military first for intelligence analyst, went to Afghanistan for a year. That it opened my eyes kind of to see a little bit more in depth of how society runs outside of, you know, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, so I had no idea about any other cultures, societies. And that got me interested in sociology to learn about different societies. Then I went into counterintelligence in DC, and I got a GS-13 position, which I loved. But then the pandemic started, and that's when we decided to switch from that living the normal lifestyle of going to work 9 to 5, you know, having a boss and a supervisor, to doing everything ourselves.
Mm-hmm. What was the kind of culture shock that you've written about that you encountered when you left that old life behind?
I don't even know if we can.
It was tremendous.
Yeah. To pick one is kind of a difficult thing. I'm currently, and it's ready for actually pre-sale now for Kindle. I'm talking about the psychology of collapsing. For us, the culture shock was a huge feeling of anime, being outside of society, where we had modernization and modernity right at our fingertips, but we decided we need to simplify and become more resourceful than we already were.
Yeah, and it was forced upon us. We couldn't afford to buy a $250,000 house and do everything that we were told that we should be doing when we left the apartment. So we had to downsize considerably, and as Greer would say, collapse now and avoid the rush. And it was a collapse for us mentally, physically, emotionally. It was really tough at the beginning because we were dealing with not only the macro picture of the world ending with the pandemic and the shutdowns, but also just that huge change that Christopher Michael was just saying, that we had grown up our entire lives, mm-hmm. that we could just flip a switch and have electricity. We could have turn a knob and have hot running water, which is a miracle, and to nothing, mm-hmm. because we didn't have the whole solar panel system hooked up yet. We didn't even have the well dug yet. So we had to go to the stream to collect water. And we did it at a good time of the year, but it was still really stressful. And we kind of mentally went our own way, even though we were, you know, partners and living in the same house. You know, we were just so stressed and internalized a lot of it. And then we had a big argument, mm-hmm. that really changed the direction that we were going down, because we worked it out and we talked about it. And that was really critical for our success here, was to talk it out and be on the same team.
And we really started to invest in our mental health and emotional intelligence, which is just as important in this type of situation as being able to grow your own food.
Absolutely.
Doesn't it strike you that this is a remarkably non-mentally healthy culture that we live in?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What do you make of it?
All the time. I don't even know where to begin. So
it's unspeakable.
Yeah, everything's upside down, right sides up, squares or circles. Everyone is kind of living in their own reality, and then ignoring with cognitive dissonance anything that disrupts that or challenges it. Mm-hmm. And it's a sickness. This is the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, you said in one of your blogs that you were influenced by internet influencers. Is that a generational thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say so. Although I can see a lot of older people on Facebook that I think they're their own version of influencers with their book clubs and their yard sale type of things. But yeah, I think influencers, when it comes to millennials or Gen Z, we personally ourselves believe that that's the narcissism that society has been mm-hmm. pushing mm-hmm. for a while now.
Because if you don't have your... Go ahead.
Well, Chris M., I'm just wondering, you worked in Washington in mm-hmm. Army intelligence. Did you find that the military has any real cognizance of the prospect of collapse?
No, they're in their own little bubble. I think we like to call it, my friends that are out and we're veterans now, the old army and then the new army. we were starting, I got out of the Army in 2015. So we were starting to get some of the wokeness, but I think they're so, they're in such a bad spot right now because of the force vaccinations of the entire force, and the wokeness that they're pushing, and to have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs talk about he wants to understand white aggression or something like that. It's not what I remember when I was in. So I think they've completely lost the message.
And what does that imply to you about the rest of the actual government itself?
I think we're all on different planes of existence right now. There's people that understand what objective reality is, that we're in a bad situation with peak oil. We're seeing it with the economy. It's just on the fritz, elections, and everyone just seems to be losing their minds because the most important thing is pronouns.
Yeah. So you got this piece of land down in Virginia, and it's a long ways from D.C.
Yes, thankfully.
Quite a 3-hour drive. And what kind of dwelling did you choose to build, and why? And Chris S., why did you, what happened to the tiny house that you had built before?
Well, excellent question. We had decided that we wanted to get a place that was good to grow tea. And at the beginning, looking back, I mean, hindsight's everything. I was looking at a good climate, good, basically level grounds that we could farm tea on. And that was it. I wasn't looking at the culture. I wasn't looking at the expense, the distance from a community, all that sort of stuff that's critical. But we decided to get this place. It's 11 acres in the middle of a cornfield. It's in Appalachia. And we have a stream on the one side of the property, which was a huge selling point. And we figured that if we had a stream and it was relatively flat, that we could get well water easily if we dug down enough. And it did work out that it was 11 feet down, which is really sustainable. Mm-hmm. And originally we had decided, okay, well, let's get a shed and convert that into a tiny house. So I used a pretty popular shed company. I used their online design software and made this beautiful modern farmhouse looking shed. And when we had it delivered, it was a wreck inside. They had put the house wrap on the inside of the house. And it was crazy. There was nails sticking out of the 2x4s. The tar paper had rips all through it. So I had them take it back and get refunded. And then we had to talk about, okay, what's our next option? And we decided, well, you know what? Let's try shipping containers. So we found a company out of the port of Baltimore that had them. They were really cheap at the time, and they were used containers. So we had that delivered. We have 2 20-foot containers joined together at the center, and we decided to go this route with it. We liked that it was affordable. It wasn't because it was trendy. It was because we had a limited budget, and we figured, okay, well, since our skills aren't great at building a house, we already have the walls, the roof, and the floor already made with the containers. So structurally, it's not as important. So then we went and started to follow this guy on YouTube. And to make a long story short, he had terrible construction experience with it. So after a few months, we found out that, oh, geez, there's a huge condensation problem in the house. So then we had to rip everything out.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so we
got here. You mean framing lumber?
Yes, everything. Strip it all the way back down to the container walls.
Dang.
And then,
It was like the Amazon rainforest in here. It was absolutely insane because it just got trapped behind the vapor barrier that we had set up. Yeah. And we did foam insulation and we did foam board. It just was not.
You have to make it absolutely tight. Yeah. You can't have any water vapor get in there, because as soon as it hits the container on the inside, it's going to condense. So we learned that you do a 2-inch foam board up against the container wall, and then you can stud it all out. Mm-hmm. And then in between the studs, you do closed cell spray foam. And we did all of that. So it is complete. It's basically a structure within a structure to keep the interior moisture that we put out a lot of from hitting the container itself. So on social media, when you see tiny houses and you can look up and see the original container roof, they're having massive condensation problems. They might tell you it's great, look at my boobs, everything's perfect. No, they're having condensation problems. So
it sounds like it might have actually been worth it more to go to all the trouble of learning how to cut, bird's eye cuts in a roof rafter so that you could, build a proper house with a proper roof.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and also we had to charge our batteries with the truck. So we were using a Porter cable, handsaw, hand drill, and a reciprocator
step by step
to build everything.
Did you feel that you learned a lot about carpentry in the process?
Oh, yes.
Yes. And ourselves too, because I had zero construction experience. Mm-hmm. And, when everything's perfect online, somebody is paying someone to do it, because I tell you what, my joints are not perfect. I have to use trim to cover up things, as much as I try to get that perfection. I mean, it takes time.
I mean, we had to learn carpentry. We had to learn how to do the electrical, the plumbing, the
drywall,
all that
everything,
stuff.
Yeah. Everything from scratch. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I understand that you ran into a lot of criticism and disrespect on Reddit. It sounds like apart from everything else that you are actually real children of the internet age.
Yes, yes.
Personally, I suspect that the internet might be a rather transient phenomenon in the human condition. Mm-hmm. Since it's utterly dependent on a reliable electric grid. Mm-hmm. And I can tell from your writing that you're not too sanguine about the prospect for a reliable electric grid. So what do you think when you imagine the future of the internet?
We don't think it's going to be around much longer, because just like you said, you have to have a reliable network. They have these massive, warehouses that is making the internet continually go, and that's so much power. We talk about it all the time. With
you mean the servers?
The servers for the internet, all these different websites. So the way that we're looking at it is we're trying to get out as much information as we can through our website and writing and books, and also talking to people, and also get out as much information as we can. We're writing down recipes, old ways to do things, how to make our own medicine with the stuff that we grow on the property. So we're using it right now for what it is. It's a tool. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be here. And it could not be here, I don't know, next 20 years. We have no idea.
Could be sooner than that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're kind of assembling your own manual of instructions for how to live a future life.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, it's really a shame because, with the fall of the Roman Empire, we don't have much of their music, I believe. And it's really sad that we're going to lose so much wonderful information. So like you're saying, we're just making a Library of Alexandria, trying to get everything that we can and have it in writing or just store it in our minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Romans didn't have musical notation, and we kind of take that for granted now. Mm-hmm. That it was developed in, I guess, really in the 17th and 18th century, probably. Mm-hmm. Something like that, maybe 16th century. But they didn't have anything like that. We have no idea what their music sounded like. We have a lot of their literature and their letters and their speeches and their histories, but not that, and not a lot of other stuff. What did you guys learn about your own mental strengths as a result of the early going in this adventure?
We learned pretty quickly. You have to be emotionally resilient or it's just not going to work. So for anyone that decides to, kind of collapse now or simplify, move off grid, you're going to find out. And I talk about it in the book that's coming out. I do an emotional timeline of collapse, and I do it from our perspective of we chose it. So this is what it kind of looks like, because you still go through the emotions of feeling detached or isolated. When it happens for society, it looks like it's kind of like steep cliffs, and then there's a little bit of a decline, and then it plateaus and it goes back up. And I think we're going to start getting some whiplash from it, and people are going to really sink into their cognitive dissonance. I think what we learned, the most important thing for ourselves, is open communication. That if you're upset about something, just say it.
Yeah.
Stop worrying about what people are thinking about you.
That's huge for us. Yeah.
Yeah. We were absolutely people pleasers, I think, going into this. And even when we started writing, thinking, oh, are people going to like this? Are they going to, respond to it well? And then we got into thinking, it really doesn't matter, mm-hmm. What other people think, because we know it's working, because we've been doing this almost 3 years now, living off grid.
Brian, I do want to say that both of us come from abusive households, and so that people pleasing was really huge for our survival, living up, with our parents. And so we just carried that on into adulthood. And now that we have the ability to work on ourselves and our mental state, we're finding out that it doesn't matter what someone says online, halfway around the world, that's going to poo-poo what we're doing, because it's not going to affect my apple trees growing. It's not going to disrupt my chickens from laying eggs or harm them in any way. So why are we holding back our authentic selves, worrying about what someone else is going to think about it? And until people want to do what we're doing, like, why do we need to be so concerned about that and held up about their opinions?
Well, you too have voluntarily more or less dropped out of the, current American rat race, to use a very old trope. What about those people we just talked about who are not doing well with their mental health? And what kind of process do you imagine that they're going to be faced with?
I think cognitive dissonance is the number one thing that is the problem right now. So a lot of people know that something's wrong. They can feel it in themselves. There's just that dissonance. It's uncomfortable, and it's important to understand that it's uncomfortable. But so many people, they'll just take that dissonance and just straight ignore it. They'll rationalize it so they can say, oh, okay, For example, if you harp on, wow, you shouldn't kill animals, you shouldn't torture them, but then you go and then buy meat and then eat it. I was having a conversation with someone recently that we were just talking about meat and different things, and she said, all I know is that my meat comes in a styrofoam package from the grocery store. And that's the thing. They're just kind of ignoring it. So I think what's really going to happen, that cognitive dissonance is going to get stronger and stronger. Some people are going to understand it and answer the questions to get that balance back in their lives. Some people are not going to do well with it at all.
How much of this cognitive dissonance that we observe do you think is responsible for causing so much of the craziness in our national life now?
I think it has to 100%. Well, I wouldn't say 100%. I would say probably 80%, and then the other 20% is the people that are in charge that are supposed to know better, that are making poor policy decisions based off of who knows what at this point.
It's true, because a lot of it is, it's tough how much is orchestrated, how much is just a natural order of evil people being in charge. A lot of it is orchestrated. They want to have so much PSYOP going on. I mean, my goodness, the military has their own PSYOP
units.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the 4th and 8th when I was.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. And so it's like a lot of it is deliberate to make people worked up, to make people feel isolated, to make them angry. And they can only see through one lens. And that's a political lens, that if you're not agreeing 100% with what I say, you need to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a huge problem.
Yeah, it's pretty grim that way. Chris S., what was your job or a vocation before you dropped out and after you left college?
After college, I worked at an organic orchard for several years. And then I got into permaculture design and sustainable living, which I was helping people just design their properties and their house and their way of life. And then that really just turned into a place here that we can consult with other people that are interested in doing it and help them out as much as possible. I think what is really important is telling people that we wouldn't want somebody to do something that we're not comfortable with. So when we're encouraging others to take on this alternative way of living, we mean it, and we're there with them, and we want to support them and get that message out that there is an alternative to the tyranny that we're seeing right now in real time.
Yeah.
Because the
Chris M, what did you, as a government employee, what did you observe about the quality of management generally in the Washington leadership corps?
Well, I started in intelligence, I would say professionally. I was a contractor for a year, and then I was hired as a GS-13. So it's a government official in the ranks, so to speak. But what I observed was a lot of overpaid, we'll say adult children that don't do any work. In the organization that I was in, which I'm not going to say it, it's not important. I think it's probably similar in any government office that you go into. People have been there for 20 or 30 years. They're making ridiculous amount of money to not have a lot of skills, kind of do the bare minimum. I saw a lot of people, they have a yearly review, and that's how you get more money. You get bonuses for that. You get a step up in your pay. That's what they worked for, to get the bullet points on the paper. I'm sure there are good government employees out there. I just haven't met many of them.
Chris S., it sounds like you started this adventure with some horticultural skills and gardening skills, tree skills, fruit skills.
Yes.
How did you get started cultivating the land?
When I was in high school, I didn't have a ton of friends, but I could go out and gather nuts and seeds and plant the heck out of my property. And that really started the whole cultivation of my passion for plants. And then it evolved into edible plants. And then when I found permaculture just out of college, that really sparked my interest in like, oh, I can really apply this to how people live sustainably. And it really took off from there. So I taught myself how to graft here, and by sitting in front of the wood stove my first winter here, and just going again and again and again. And it was very successful. So I love applying my passion and purpose with those plants on how to help people create sustainable systems, because food is going to dominate our lives like crazy. We need food like the economy needs fossil fuels. So that's what we need to really be prioritizing. And it's really sad because not many people are. You know, I'm writing a book about Appalachia right now and how to redesign it for a future of less. And I was researching that NASA did a study about lawns, and the U.S. has 63,000 miles of lawns.
Square miles of lawns.
It says that it's about the same size of Texas.
Wow.
And it's three times larger than any other irrigated or farmed crop in the United States.
Yeah.
So I think the amount of suffering that we're going to see is directly proportional to the amount of lawns that we currently see right now.
How did you get started cultivating the particular land that you're on in Virginia? When you landed there and you're on basically a bare field, you've got two shipping containers joined together for dwelling, and you're faced with having to break the sod for the first time. And how'd that all get started, and how'd you start?
Well, Christopher got me the Intro to Permaculture book by Bill Mollison, and I had been reading that religiously for at least a year. And then once we got on the property full time, I was able to really dedicate the time and energy. And I really did. I went overboard with it, digging myself into the ground, literally trying to make the gardens. Because in the book, they have a step-by-step plan on what you're supposed to do, how the zones work. And it's all about energy. Basically, I think, Jim, you wrote the book because it's about energy flows. So, you know, the chicken coop that you're going to multiple times a day is going to be closer to the house than that nut tree that you harvest once a year. So that really decided where I put everything in the landscape. And, you know, it's on 11 acres, but because we're off grid and everything is done by hand, you know, it takes a while to really develop it. So I still have, God, you know, I probably only have 2 acres of intensively developed land so far within 3 years, but I'm slowly working my way out. You're supposed to nail it and then scale it. So get it right in a small area just outside the back door and work your way to the edges of the property from then.
I found that fencing was a big issue when, you know, when I built my gardens. How did all those things come together for you?
Well, we actually have, well, it might be a little bit different now, but we have 24 deer that walk through the neighborhood. And so we had to put up, it's actually a very simple design. It's just a regular field fencing that you would get from Tractor Supply with T-posts every 10 feet. And then I have 2 lines of non-electrified electric wire above that. So there's 7-foot T-posts. And that has actually been able to keep the deer out for the 3 years that we've been here. And I actually have the, around the house, it's in a, what in permaculture is called an arc, solar arc. So it deflect, it's a windbreak in a semicircle around the house. And the natural curves of that, I found that the deer will just follow that around and not come straight into the property, into the 2 acres of where the gardens and the fruit trees are. So that natural curve kind of deflects them away. Then if I had a square, for instance, that those hard lines actually would probably encourage them to just try to jump over it.
Because I had to put a deer fence up around my property when I.
That's right.
They were. It was like a petting zoo.
And they just eat. They just eat everything for the first.
Yeah, and I was going to put in fruit trees, and you know they never would have survived because when the fruit trees arrived from the from Fedco. They were what's called whips, which means they're like 2 foot high stick, you know, with roots on them. The Vaulted program, backed by David McElvaney's ICA group, allows gold investors to participate for as little as $50. In times of high inflation, you might be looking to put your money into real assets, something like gold, perhaps, which has proven itself throughout history as a reliable way to protect and grow your savings during periods of market uncertainty. And you may have heard that the best way to invest in gold is to actually buy physical gold. Well, Vaulted is the mobile platform and app that allows investors to purchase physical gold. The gold is real, and it's stored at the Royal Canadian Mint. You can also take physical delivery right to your home if you'd like. It takes less than a minute to set up an account. Vaulted offers the lowest transaction fees and features the best cost structure in the industry. You can buy and sell your gold at any point, and there's even an automatic savings program called Vault Plan that investors can set up to automatically purchase gold every month. Buying or selling gold is as easy as buying stock. There is no minimum investment either. You'll even get a personal advisor to speak with at any time if you have any questions about the gold markets. Learn more today by clicking the link in my show notes or by visiting kunstler.com/vaulted. Vaulted is backed by the McElvaney Financial Group, which owns ICA, one of the largest and longest continuously operating full-service gold brokerage firms in the United States. And now back to the show. What's been going on with the tea project? And tell me something. We think of tea as being a kind of a tropical crop, you know, grown in Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia, India. How are you going to grow tea in Virginia?
Well, it's funny that you said the Sri Lankan, because I was actually researching this for a few years before we made the move onto the property. And there was a guy that actually said in a forum, he was laughing about people in the United States trying to grow tea. So I was like, all right, dude, challenge accepted. So then I started researching more and more, and I found out that, oh, wow, okay, so in North Carolina, there's actually a company that grows and sells tea. And then I was like, oh, well, I can get the seeds because it's a lot cheaper. I mean, this is definitely on a budget. So it's a lot cheaper to grow it from seeds. So then I found a seed source in New England from Sheffield Seed Company. And so I planted out a pound of that. And so it's been a very slow process, but, you know, it takes time, but it's enough for us right now to have some tea during the wintertime. And the Camellia sinensis plant is actually a little bit more cold hardy than what we would actually think.
Yeah,
it is.
I think of some tea coming from actually the mountainous areas of India, up by the Himalayas.
Yep, correct. Yes, and then South Korea and Japan as well.
Oh yeah.
So so it's actually been working. The plants that people say should be growing here, so like the Sochi tea, does not work here at all. It's not cold hardy. If you look on the map, it's like a zone 8.
So what are you growing? Zone.
So I'm growing, it's a Korean tea. Uh-huh. So the it's still Camellia sinensis, but it's from Korea, South Korea. So it's actually roughly the same latitude as Virginia.
And that grows on a bush?
Yes, it's an evergreen bush. And you harvest the new growth on it, the top three leaves of it, and then you can dry it out. And that's where white tea, black tea, green tea comes from.
Are you going to start processing it and selling it?
Absolutely, yes.
It sounds like a long-term project.
Yes, it definitely is. It's not something that you can just start, you know, with, say, meat chickens or something like that and have a crop within 6 months. It's probably going to take me 6 years to grow enough and then and plant out and then harvest it. But I think it's a very good long-term thing. I think what people need to start thinking about is how are we going to source things locally?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think the supply lines to China are going to last. That place is a basket case right now. So, you know, as you were talking about the servers for the internet, I mean, all the parts, the rare earth metals to run all of that, you know, China is not a long-term guarantee. So yeah, we need to be able to source things. And you've talked about, you'd be able to make brooms locally and shoes and clothes. So that's, you know, this is one thing I can kind of merge my addiction and passion with plants to try to grow something that people would use in the future that's medicinal, but also has caffeine and is very good.
I'm a tea drinker myself.
Good.
I hardly drink any coffee. And I've been a tea drinker for a long time. Coffee makes me grind my teeth.
Yes, me too. Yeah.
Now, what happened with the actual food garden? Because that can be quite a steep learning curve in terms of the finer points of things that actually make it to the table and things that don't.
Yeah, I think in our first year here, we tried to plant stuff. The soil was so degraded that we weren't able to really get any type of harvest. And we decided one of the systems that we started to use was compost tea. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Hey, and was it in tobacco before?
It was in corn and soybean for at least 50 years, probably corn, maybe even the past 100 years.
Okay.
I mean,
because tobacco will really ruin soil.
Oh, absolutely. Fast. You know, yeah, sure. And that's a little bit further south than us. But yeah, absolutely. It's a huge issue. And we had epic soil collapse here. There was no earthworms. They had sprayed the heck out of it. We had GMO corn grown here for decades.
Wow.
And they had put a lot of synthetic fertilizers. And so the salts in that just killed all the soil life. So we were really starting from scratch. And it was very tough the first year. But like Chris just said, we got into the composting tea. We made our own little system, running it off the pathetic solar system that we had, our first iteration of that. But we were able to really, and it takes time. I really want to stress that with people that you see on YouTube and on social media, everything is perfect and they have this abundant harvest. But for us, it's the third year is when everything clicked. And we've gone through, like you said, the learning curve of, okay, what eats what plant, what crop should we be focusing on? When the first and second year, we were working on kind of fiddly crops, salad greens, different tomatoes, things like that. And, you know, those are nice, but they don't store well.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the canning, it actually does take quite a bit of materials for that.
You bet.
And so we're like, okay, this year, let's focus on the staples. So that's potatoes, that's sweet potatoes, that's beans. We do have some sweet corn. That's peanuts, that's Chinese yam, which is a perennial. That's carrots. We're planting chestnuts and all that sort of stuff for long-term perennial food crops. But that's what we're focusing on right now. And Chris, you can go into all the great stuff that you were doing with the processing and preserving.
Oh yeah. One of the things was we wanted to make things as simple as possible. So we really enjoy green beans, and we like to have that with kind of like ramen. So I learned how to make a pasta from scratch using stuff that we grow here. And then the way that we did the green beans is called leather britching, which is, I don't know if it's outside of Appalachia, but
I've heard of it.
Yeah, so you basically just sew the green beans together in a long string, mm-hmm. Dry them out, you're good to go. So we just have them in a storage container. But yeah, we stored pickles and sauce and all kinds of different things.
What are you making pasta out of?
Out of wheat. And
oh, you're growing wheat?
Yep. Yeah, we're doing winter wheat. We had a little patch. Now we're making it bigger. We want to see how much we can get out of. I think we did like 100 square feet, but we're gonna, as Chris said before, nail it and then scale it. Yeah, but we have the wheat, so we have a grinder, and then I have the eggs from our wonderful chicken ladies, and we have oil that we can make because we have an oil press. We really took basically our life savings, and instead of putting it into something like the stock market, we put it into actual physical, I would say, tools and all these different things.
Yeah, living capital and physical, yeah, like you said, tools that will help us, that will improve our life and our standard of living considerably.
How did you sort out your needs from your wants?
That's a really good question.
Yeah, I love that question.
I think that is the question, because when we first, I guess, chose to go this route, it was incredibly difficult that we've talked about, emotionally, just because you have modernity so close. And I think life tells you your needs, and you might want something, but if it's just not going to happen, it's not going to happen.
Because with Chris really enjoys watching movies.
Yeah.
And we found out really quickly, even with the small LED flat screen, that the solar panels, when we had really crappy solar panels the first time, that it wasn't going to get powered by it.
It was just so unnecessary.
Yeah.
And so we just were like, you know what? Get rid of it. We don't need a TV.
Well, remember, reading a novel is a manual of instructions for running a movie in your head.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I read voraciously all of the time. Mm-hmm. We both love reading because we get so much satisfaction out of learning. Yeah. And so reading is the best thing for us here.
That's a really good point. I did want to say that people have really forgotten how to enjoy life. And when we're sitting in front of our chickens and some jump on our lap and others are just sleeping right next to us, there's a tremendous amount of value, substance, and joy with that, that people think that if they adapt to this type of living, that their whole world implodes. And that's not true. There's a tremendous amount of stuff that we've lost.
You can live without social media and Facebook.
And that air conditioning.
My goodness. Yeah.
How about the, a lot of people think, and myself included, actually, that hot water is really the hallmark of being civilized. And yet you've concluded that it's not quite as necessary as people think.
Well, I would say it's not technically necessary. It's certainly a luxury.
Yeah.
And we spent some time and understanding not having hot water. And then so what we did was we actually set up a system that has a propane heater. Mm-hmm. So if someone wants to say, okay, that's not off grid, then cool, whatever. But yeah, it's certainly a luxury. And there's other ways to do it. We've been flirting with kind of the idea of a thermosiphon, mm-hmm. to use the pipe of the wood stove to heat the water that way. That's a way but we haven't gone that route yet, but it's another thing that you can do.
Yeah, like during the summertime, we have these cast iron Walmart pails that we fill up with the well water, mm-hmm. and we sit out in the sun, and it gets, it's perfect.
They make cast iron pails? Are they kettles or what?
Just it's stainless steel.
Stainless steel.
Oh, okay. Steel. Yeah. That's the different.
But it's, that's really simple. But I absolutely agree with you. It's a tremendous luxury to have that hot water cascading over you when you may not be able to shower every single day.
Yeah.
And
there are ways of setting up hot water systems that don't involve, motors or
absolutely.
Electricity or anything. It just, gravity and a black vessel that is overhead that's painted, black. absorb sun. Have you tried any of those?
We haven't tried any of those yet.
We're definitely working on that.
Yeah, we're working on that. So that's the thing about living like this, and the way that we do it is we're looking for all of those different things.
Yeah.
And we like to talk about that on our website, and we want to get more people talking about it, because we're just two people. But if you have a lot of other people on their own land innovating themselves, we're going to come up with a really good system of how to do things the simplest way with the least amount of inputs.
Yeah. Well, you know, the people who settled Virginia and really the United States in the early going, they were creative and resilient people who learned how to create a manner of life that was not punishing. Or at least not for everybody. It was probably pretty rigorous, you know.
Depends on who you ask, right?
Yeah, but it's possible to be civilized in a non-electric society.
Absolutely, and that's what...
We have plenty of historic houses where I am in the Hudson Valley in New York, you know, where you can actually see how people did it. You know, they had outdoor ovens and they had ways of lighting the house and using daylight to do it. And, you know, just about every kind of creative thing imaginable to make life comfortable.
Definitely. Yeah. And why not reuse that, build on that knowledge and, you know, kind of retrofit your type of lifestyle to what you need.
How much of that are you able to access, that knowledge, rather than just, you know, modern YouTube DIY kind of stuff?
We haven't run into kind of those issues yet, because our version of Collapse has been kind of on a steady path. So we're constantly trying to come up with those things. The only way that we can do that, we've been to the library, we've looked at how people in old Appalachia have lived, and we have the Foxfire series, which is interviews with people who were far more resilient than anybody is.
Well, those books came out in the 1970s, and they were interviewing people who had really been born in the 19th century. So They lived through the transition between the unelectrified rural South and then the coming of electricity in the 1930s.
Yeah, absolutely. And to go back a little bit to what you were asking, you kind of just how we live our life, important things are priorities and they stay. But things that are really frivolous, like the TV, for instance, or the air conditioning, they just fall to the side, and you just continue life and you adapt to it with the hot water. You know, we use the small propane cooker to heat it up if we need to, or on a sunny day like this, if the container's black, it heats up very well, even in the wintertime. You know, that's an alternate way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to have hot water to wash our dishes. So that cuts out a considerable amount of wasted energy. And we haven't gotten sick. You know, we use a Berkey water filter. So, you know, it works.
How far are you from, like, the nearest, you know, center of modernity?
I would say it's about 40 minutes, 40 minutes to an hour.
To a city with about 100,000 people.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. We're able to get, you know, go out and get the things that we need in town. We try not to leave that often, because we're working with the constraints that everyone is under right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely, because we're writing and we have so much work to do during a little bit less during the wintertime. Uh-huh. But, you know, during the summertime, it is go constantly, because we're watering everything by hand from the central point of the well, you know, so it takes a while to do some things. But, yeah, we go out once a week, get the things that we need. And we're not 100%, you know, I'm not trying to deceive anyone. We're not 100%. You know, completely off grid. We go to the store to get food. You know, it takes time. And that's why we want to encourage people that you don't start preparing a garden when Walmart or the grocery store is closed and you can't get food anymore. Yeah. You know?
Well, listeners might be wondering, how are you connected to the internet?
So we have our website. Sorry.
Yeah, where you are. How are you connected to the web?
so we have on our cell phones, it's just an unlimited plan. And for us, that's just the easiest thing. So we're able to
for a hotspot.
Yeah, to tether our computer to the phone for a hotspot. And we have pretty good signal here.
Have you been following the news? You guys are clearly familiar with the scenario for a collapse of industrial economies, and we seem to be entering the really lively phase of all that. So what do you make of where we're at now, late in 2022, just entering the holiday season and after the election, and given the events of the day?
I think we pay attention to the news because we don't want to get caught off guard. We try not to pay attention too much because I think a lot of it is really, these days, it's just whatever the propaganda machine wants us to understand what's happening. We like the alternate forms of media, going on Twitter and kind of seeing what people in those places are talking about. I think we're just as worried as other people right now, even though I think we're probably a lot more prepared than most people for for like a societal type collapse, especially with the economy. We have our own work. It's been pretty steady. We have writing, so there's a passive income from that as well. And we're really worried just about being able to get the fundamental things of the food, medicine, that those are the big things, because we aren't able to produce that here. So we're looking into, you know, other ways to try to get that to work.
Do you even care about the politics of the day, the elections and all that, and who's in Washington running what?
I think our answer is we couldn't care less.
Yes. You know, Dmitry Orlov talks about how it doesn't matter who is in the White House. The oligarchs are still going to do what they're going to be doing. And I couldn't agree more with that. And I think politics are the most useless topic that Americans should be focusing on right now.
I got to stop writing about it.
Well, you know what? It's funny that you say that, because we read your blog and that's enough. Like, we know what's going on. And as we're building our resilience, it dawned on me this summer that I was like, you know what? When you're doing all of this, you don't need to worry as much about what's going on because you're doing the best you can with the resources that you have. And, you know, so the hand wringing goes away. A lot of the anxiety just fades away. And you know what? If it falls apart, I can't stop an EMP. I can't stop economic collapse. I can't stop the WEF doing their stupid crap. But I can plant a fruit tree. I can take care of my chickens. I can take care of my mental health. That's where it really counts. And that's where we focus on.
Do you expect a significant population drop in your lifetimes?
Absolutely.
I think we're starting to see it. We're starting to see it now with the birth rates that are being affected all around the world, which, I wonder what that could be.
Yeah, all those, the jab, absolutely, with people dropping like flies.
Did you manage to avoid the jab?
Absolutely. Yeah. Ivermectin works.
I think we were supposed to die last winter, but we made it somehow.
Yeah, Joe. What was that?
Oh, yeah, that was going to be the winter of death from Uncle Joe. So you call your website the New Revenant Society. And for those people who are wondering, revenants, the word revenant is a synonym really for ghost.
For rebirth.
So that includes the idea of rebirth
idea. We're saying we need a new type of society. We're not trying to overthrow anybody.
Yes, make that clear.
We're going to make that clear. But no, we need a rebirth of a society that is based on sustainable living and personal resilience is an important thing for us. So we really actually took a lot of time to come up with that name so that it had a lasting effect, that we need something new has to happen.
Are you the ghosts of the oil age?
That's a good way to look at it.
I hope so.
Yeah,
we're gonna steal that, and it'll be our autobiography.
If we can haunt the oligarchs, you know, Christine Lagarde and all of them, Klaus Schwab and his droopy face. Yeah, that would be nice.
I think we're at the core of it. We're incredibly worried for our generation specifically, and the generations that are younger than us right now, because a lot of the people that are currently making the decisions that we feel are pulling us further and further into the abyss aren't going to be here in 50 years. Yeah. With any luck, we'll be here in 50 years. I have no idea what it's going to look like because we're past peak oil, so we're going to be on the decline, and it's already seemed to start happening faster and faster.
Yeah, picking up. And I do want to say that, you know, we have a mental health crisis just as much as we have a peak oil crisis, mm-hmm. because the upper classes, the oligarchs, as I call them, don't want to give up any of their privileges and entitlements. And then also the lower classes, so the middle, the working and the lower classes, they don't want to give anything up either. So I don't see us going out gracefully. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a very tough time, and a lot of people are going to die. A lot of people are going to suffer needlessly, because we even with all the stuff going on today, we can still access supplies from Lowe's or Amazon or wherever else, mm-hmm. that, and we're just wasting that away on our lawns, on our leisure time. You know, there's $50 billion spent on boats and marine stuff every single year.
Oh my
gosh. It's absurd that we're wasting our time on this stuff.
Well, one of the things that gives me a little bit of hope about the situation is that as all of us might agree, the whole disposition of commercial life in America is really perverse and
yes.
Distorted with just, you know, big box stores really servicing just about everything that people need. But what that tells you is that, first of all, things tend to evolve to their largest size just before they go extinct.
Correct, yes.
So that applies to commerce as well. But it also means that there are going to be a lot of opportunities for younger people to rebuild local networks of mm-hmm. commerce, including stores and wholesale and distribution networks and, mm-hmm. you know, the whole kit of having some kind of a commercial economy. And, you know, you don't have to be entirely space age to have that kind of an economy. I mean, we had it in the United States really from near the very beginning to you know, until the explosion of national chain shopping and all that. So mm-hmm. I would encourage some people who, you know, are not going to go into food production or things related to it to think about how they're going to rebuild their local networks of, you know, distribution of goods and even the making goods locally in ways that, are going to have to be downscaled.
Yeah, we've talked about a really cool situation we think for the future is kind of getting back to the canal system.
Yeah.
There's a great, like the CNO canal. What's the one near us?
The Greenbrier River Trail.
Yep. You can set up kind of like open markets so that yeah. people can go up and down on, you know, boats, just canoes would even work for it. So that's kind of one way that we need to simplify the ability to get to those places. So if you have it on a long stretch, like a canal system.
Yeah, our canals up in New York State, which are major canals, the mm-hmm. Erie Canal and the Champlain Canal, are in immaculate condition. Luckily, they've been maintained they put a tremendous amount of effort into maintaining them for years.
That's wonderful. Yeah, there's
so we're fortunate.
The old, you know, a lot of places are tearing up their old river tracks and putting in bike lanes.
Right.
At first, I was like, you know, that seems really stupid. But then I thought about it. Well, the trains take diesel. And so if the trucking industry goes, then won't the trains go? So I was like, well, you know what? You can easily ride a bike. You can easily walk on these trails now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they follow river courses. So I think actually that might be really interesting.
Well, we'll probably need some combination of
mm-hmm. sure.
these
sure.
things. And I'm not that pessimistic about the railroad system. I mean, you can run it on other things, but, you know, will we be able to? Mm-hmm. You probably have to think of that in the context of a much downscaled population.
Sure.
It's not going to be serving, you know, over 350
right.
million people.
Right.
It's going to yeah. be yeah, a there's, smaller
there's
number.
Be a, yeah, there's going to be a hit, I think, to the population because right now the United States population is 5% of the total world population, and we consume 20% daily of the oil that the world consumes.
Yeah.
So we're going to need to drop that back down to yeah. scale.
Kicking and screaming.
And it's not going to go well.
Yeah. Do you fear for the Europeans? They're in even worse shape than we are as far as that's concerned.
Well, it's funny, you know, you talk about us going medieval, and they're the first ones to line up
Yeah,
and go.
voluntarily.
Yes.
Yeah,
And
they.
it's crazy that on YouTube, they have the little, what are they called? The TikTok things, but it's on
Oh, the
YouTube,
shorts.
the shorts. And there's this one German girl, and she's talking, like, and talk about cognitive dissonance, completely fine with freezing to death in her apartment. And she's coming up with clever ways to stay warm. And it's like all of this was preventable if your leaders hadn't sanctioned Russia. But yeah, they're going gleefully, apparently, at least the young people, from what I see on social media, right into the Middle Ages. It's crazy.
So the New Revenant Society is inviting other people to join up and come on down to Virginia and build tiny houses, I guess, on your 11 acres.
We would love to. We've talked about it. We would love to have maybe two other couples or like small families. We don't have all the logistics worked out. It would have to be a kind of a process because we'd like to trust the people that are moving there. But yeah, we want to be able to help people. That's why we're doing it. That's why, like on our website, we don't charge money for the articles. We don't have money for memberships or to be able to talk to each other because we want people to come. Learn the knowledge, leave some knowledge for other people going forward so we can kind of build, as Chris was saying earlier, that Library of Alexandria.
Sure. And you know what? Our message is not for everyone. There's a million different ways that you can simplify your life. It all comes back to the same point, but you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and people don't always like what we have to say, but we're not going to bullshit. We're not going to try to get clickbait. We're here to spread our message that this is the ups and downs, the hardships, but also the joys of this lifestyle. And you know, it's like you can stay hooked up to the grid and modernity as long as you want, but I don't think we have a whole lot of time, especially when the WEF, the UN is keep talking about 2030, man. So it would be behoove a lot of Americans to simplify so they're not dependent on these toxic people to dictate what they do.
Well, I certainly wish you guys good luck. Tell me, tell listeners where the w how they can find your website.
Yeah, so we are New Revenant, REVENANT, society.com. We have everything there, that all of our social media is on there. We've kind of pulled back from the social media. We've both been working pretty hard on doing the books that we're working on, just because we're working furiously to try to get as much information as we can out there. It helps us because we're learning and we're researching as we're going, and I'm trying to help other people too.
Well, Chris M, it sounds like you're a little bit closer to publication with yours.
Yes, it's for pre-order for Kindle right now. It's called The Psychology of Collapsing. I go into the basics of emotions and talk about what it actually means to be happy, how to deal with fear, especially as a society is collapsing. And I give an emotional timeline of collapse to kind of get people to understand these are the emotions you're going to feel. They're normal. Here's kind of how to go through them.
Well, a pleasure to check in with you, find out what's going on down in your corner of the world. You and I are doing similar things. I got the chickens, I got the garden, I got the fruit trees. I have learned it's hard to grow fruit. I did notice on your website that you were complaining that you were unable to grow the Asian pears. But I gotta say, of the 25 odd fruit trees I've got going in my little orchard, the Asian pears, 500 miles north of you, are the best producing fruit trees in my orchard.
That's amazing.
It
Good
is
for you.
amazing. They're not, nothing seems to attack them. No diseases, no insects. I get these perfect brown apple-like fruits. They're pears, but they don't taste like European pears. They have this wonderful kind of wine-like flavor. And they're beautiful. So I'm doing well with them. So I don't think it's there must be something else going on with your pears, with your
Yeah, we need
Asian
some
pears.
magic.
Yes, it's definitely the frost pocket that we live in. They bloom way too early and the frost nips them.
Because I mean, we don't get the thing is, my pears bloom in early May.
Oh, ours are in probably, yeah, end of March. That's
Well,
why.
maybe you ought to try getting them from Fedco because they're or the St. Lawrence Nursery, because those are cold hardy varieties up there.
Gotcha.
Just hey, saying, nice. Little advertisement yeah, yeah. for those outfits.
Yes, they're excellent.
Okay, gentlemen, I guess we're going to cut it from here, and thank you very much for coming on, and we will ride again.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks.
You're welcome.